Hello, listeners. Welcome to the 9 Years Podcast Lockdown Show. My name's Kevin Boris, and today I'm joined by the omnipotent George Jones. How are you doing, George?
Hi, I'm great. How are you?
Good, thank you. George was just about to have a drink then. I called him off guard. Why are you having a drink now when you know I'm going to introduce you?
Yeah, I was kind of hoping you'd go to Chris first.
Gotcha.
God. It's a week since we've done a show, and you're not prepared for it. Anyway, George, are you still in Cornwall?
Yes, I'm still in Cornwall.
Still,
and I will be here for the foreseeable future, I think.
You probably will, yes. But also joined, also on the south coast, but several hundred miles away, by Chris Draper. Hello, Chris.
Hello, all. How are you all doing? I'm trying to access my camera on this, so at least you lot can see what I look like, rather than just some still face.
Yes, because the still face is kind of disconcerting, because obviously, listeners, you can't see this, because you're listeners. But if you were viewers, you could see just a static picture of Chris. Kind of, it does follow you across the room. It's kind of unsettling. But anyway, so we have a guest now. For those of you of a certain age, I think it's a great guest. Now on the show, there he is again. Nice, thanks, Chris. So on 2 weeks ago, we had Terry Gibson on the show, a member of our FA Cup winning side, who wore the number 8 shirt. We have one of the substitutes from the FA Cup winning side. Please welcome John Scales.
Hello there.
How are you doing, John?
I'm very well. How are you doing?
Well, we're all fine. Thank you very much. It's nice to see Chris in action. Now we've got...
I've come back.
Oh, there he is.
We've got a picture of Chris and we've got an image of Chris. Chris is ceiling.
Chris can't work technologies.
It's the view of your ceiling on the radio is one of the best things I've ever been involved with.
So thank you very much. You're watching in black and white.
Yes. Yes, Chris is behind the pink. Anyway... So, John, thanks so much for joining us. What are you up to at the moment? What is your... Because as far as we saw you not that long ago helping to promote the bond scheme, which at the time seemed like a fantastic thing to do. We raised all that money for the ground, and we were thinking, well, what can stop us now? And then something stopped us. So what are you up to now?
What am I up to? I mean, I'm always obviously lending my support to the club and interested in seeing how that bond has developed, how the stadium's been developed, how the team are, how Robbo's doing with the players, how they're staying fit, and when they, you know, like everybody, intrigued when the season's going to start again. Very quiet with any media work, obviously, because there is none about, nothing going on. So, in the shutdown and lockdown, like everybody else, frustrated with not seeing, the football on the TV. No, generally just keeping the house ticking over. I've got two girls, both one's 11, one's 13. One's just finishing off prep school and one's at secondary school. So just, managing them and making sure they're linked in and connected on their Zoom classes and studying okay and keeping fit. And we're out as much as we can be, in the circumstances, going out for a run every night, every other night, staying fit, healthy. And just developing my projects. I've got a couple of projects that I'm involved with. Well, two or three actually. And I sort of focused on using this time, I suppose, to connect with people and build out the program whilst I can. And whilst, the world is in this sort of situation we find ourselves in.
So is it, I don't want to ask too much about your project. Are these sporting involvements or non-sporting?
No, they're sporting. They're all revolving around football. Heritage of football, sensor technology, one of the other projects. Another project, bizarrely, is about organic fertilizer for football pitches, but for crops. And it's micronized rock, which has got incredible properties. So bizarre thing I've never been involved with before, but which I find fascinating. So I'm helping them out. So it's all to do with football, all to do with sport. Helping out friends who are also developing projects in and around football. But, it just keeping me busy and stimulated, but not earning anything. So that's a big problem.
Yep, now how you feel there. Don't go into that. But sensors, interesting. We'll talk after this. The listeners don't want to hear this, but I was briefly involved, and still I am involved with a company that ended up developing a sensors that were going to be used in the 100 in the cricket tournament. But for replacing the sort of snickometer and knowing when the ball's actually been hit and whether it's grounded and that kind of stuff. That was interesting. So maybe we could talk about sensors after this, because I'm sure the listeners don't want to hear us talk about sensors. What they do want to hear about is your Wimbledon life. Now, can I make a point here? I wanted to say something to you that I've never had a chance to say to you that I've met you before. In the mid-90s, I was a football journalist. I wrote for Match of the day, the match, the kid stuff. Goal 4-4-2. I had a column in the Independent. I wrote a lot of stuff about football.
And he's showing off. He's showing off it.
Right? No. I bored all of those editors by often talking about how I thought you should be in the England squad, if not the team. So from the 88-89 season up to the time you left us, in my opinion, you were the best centre-half in the Premier League. You didn't get in the England squad. You got into the England B squad a couple of times, which always seemed like a bit of an insult, really, as Chris Sutton would attest to. the way I saw it was, so the first game of the 94-95 season was Coventry away, which people were surprised you played in that. There's rumours all through the summer you're going to go to Liverpool or Spurs, I think. So how I saw that timeline, you played in that game on a Saturday. On the Monday or Tuesday, you joined Liverpool. On the Friday, you were named in the England squad. Is that how it worked out? Because that always seemed like an insult to us. Nigel Winterburn, another one, who didn't get in the England squad while playing for us, joined Arsenal after four games, got in the England squad. I think you got in the England squad having not actually played for Liverpool. Is that true?
It could well be. I bow to your better memory of that moment and that week.
It rankles in me still.
Funny enough, I actually only looked back and realised that it was that England call-up when I was at Liverpool, but I didn't know the date coincided with actually probably not playing for Liverpool.
I played
those B games. Terry Venables was the England manager. It was a great time for me. I'd had the frustration the year before, with all due respect to Wimbledon. I thought I was leaving and going to Liverpool 12 months earlier when Graeme Souness was the manager.
Ah, right.
And I had to sit tight because the club wouldn't let me go. We'd talked about if a big club came in when I signed the previous contract, blah, blah, blah. You've heard it a million times. Oh, yeah, we won't stand in your way. And then, of course, when push comes to shove, it's a no. And the funny sort of story recounted of Sam Hammam writing a note saying, you know, no way, Jose. That was all he wrote on my transfer request. And declined, and I stayed, and I had a great season with Wimbledon. You know, really enjoyed my time. Got my head down and thought, well, you know, don't feel sorry for yourself. You know, you're only going to get, you know, that chance to be resurrected if you get your head down and play well again. So there was a lot of speculation about me moving and going to Blackburn as well. Kenny Dalglish was at Blackburn, and possibly Ray Harford was there then with him. It may be just coincidence that the call-up came as I moved to Liverpool, but that was the sort of culmination, I think, in my journey from getting into the game, getting established, learning my trade incredibly hard work at the start, learning from Don Howe, the other players. The lessons learned from that group of players was phenomenal. And then the culmination, as you say, of moving to Liverpool and getting the England call-up was sort of quite an overwhelming experience because... Right. The relief of signing for Liverpool that week, when you imagine the 12 months prior, thinking I'd missed that opportunity, I think I was about 28, was palpable. So, privileged and proud to play for England, of course. Although I regret, you know, there was only, I think I had three caps in the end. Well, I know I had three caps, but injuries beset me. And that was the frustrating thing that, you know, I believed in my talent and my ability was shown by Terry Venables, but injury's gone in the way for me.
Did you get, though, during your last season, was there any pressure from anybody, wouldn't know who it come from, that you knew that if once you left, you'd get a call-up? Was there any sort of, in any meetings with players knowing that you weren't going to get in the squad because of who you played for? Or was that just, you just thought that must be the case? Because surely, I know it maybe didn't read, wasn't so much pressing, but... You know,
no, I think that's part and parcel of a player's career, that you appreciate that when you've played the game, you played the game at the highest level, you know what it takes to play at the very highest level in those sorts of clubs, Liverpool, United, Chelsea, Arsenal, you know, the big clubs. It comes with a totally different sort of pressure and intensity and scrutiny. And again, you know, when you look at the lesser clubs, I think... You know, coaches who have been in the game a long time, when they become England manager, international managers, when they become managers of big clubs, it is all about the personality. And you need to sort of test that personality only when they're in an incredibly hostile, scrutinised, high-pressured environment, playing with good players, but being able to demonstrate that they are capable of bringing their game into that environment with those good players. And I think it's fair enough. There are of course players who have missed out not playing international football because they've been at lesser clubs who probably would have absolutely flourished. But you know, by and large, I think you need to have been in that to understand it is a very, very different sort of set of circumstances when you're playing at that level.
Yeah, because I think a lot of us as Wimbledon fans in those days, we said, right, as soon as a player gets picked for England, we're all going to go. And then we came. And then 1989, Mr. Fashanu got picked for in this England in the Stanley Rouse Cup, which is a round tournament between England, Chile and Scotland. We went to Wembley, very, very proud in our Wimbledon shirts to watch John Fashanu play for England. And then at half time, most of us put our coats on and zipped them up so people couldn't see who we supported. I mean, not being horrible to him. I would say this to his face. He was a game. It was so poor in that match. It was unbelievable. And I just don't know whether his performance in that game set back everybody else. Chris, you're laughing. Please feel free.
Yeah, absolutely.
It wasn't great, was it?
Bless him, he wasn't the best representative, shall we say, in the English shirt.
No. Did Dennis Wise play for England with us, or had he gone to Chelsea by that point?
I think he'd gone by then.
I think he'd gone, hadn't he?
He'd gone, yeah.
It was
pretty much half the course, I think.
That's it. I've only been to 5 England games in my life, and I've gone with other people every time. I've never actually bought a ticket. Partly for that reason. So, John, we've got some questions from our lovely listeners. Can we ask you a couple of questions? These are good ones. Don't worry. These are not questions about anyone.
I won't judge the quality of the question, I promise you. I'll just try and answer.
That'd be great. Thanks, Raj. So this is from Matt Harwood. Matt says, I always wondered, in the 1988 FA Cup final, when you came on as a sub for Terry Gibson, did you have any prior warning that you'd be going on up front? Or was it a complete surprise? Also, what was your favourite game in a Wimbledon shirt apart from the final?
Apart from the final, my favourite Wimbledon game, probably the semi-final at White Hart Lane. That was a great, great game, great atmosphere, great feeling to be part of that team and to know at the end of it that we've got ourselves to Wembley, got ourselves to the cup final, played in the game, you know, euphoric. It was just, you know, a great moment. I think that was the highlight for me with Wimbledon. There were many, but, you know, it was always great when you went and upset the odds of the big clubs. You know, you remember moments more than, you know, specific game and what it was, you know. The tunnel, the atmosphere at the Old Plough Lane against Manchester United with Viv Anderson and Fash and the sort of set to and the whole sort of intensity that Plough Lane had for a club like us. I've just been watching the docu-series to go off on a bit of a tangent about the Chicago Bulls. And when you look at the Detroit Pistons and the way that they were dominant against Chicago Bulls in 88, around about the same time, I think they were called the Bad Boys or something because they beat up the opposition, and they had this philosophy of going up and ganging up on Michael Jordan and stopping him playing, and they ended up winning the championship. And it's quite a lot of similarities. And you sort of get a buzz from that because you know that you're limited with maybe the ultimate skills you've got to compete on that level, but you know what your attributes are to be able to compete and win games and do well.
Yeah.
And so you always pick out those memories. But on that point, overriding from Matt's question, yeah, it's got to be that semi-final win. The first question was what about 88?
Did you know you were coming on up front when you came up for Terry Gibson?
No, I mean, the classic footage shows me running on and Vinnie Jones looking at me. And I think throughout the history of football, when a player comes on, he's there pointing, directing, reorganising things. Yeah. I come on and sort of shrug my shoulders. And they sort of look at me and go, oh my God, you're going that way. You should be going surely the other way. And that sort of summed up the surprise for me and the rest of the teammates that I was going up. Effectively, Bobby told me to run around like a headless chicken and cause as much trouble, shut down as much as I could up front, do a big job for the team. And I had half an hour to do that. And you know, it was amazing to be part of it. But you still feel like you can't help but feel like you haven't earned that medal in the same capacity as somebody else coming on as a sub. But you look through the season, the impact I had through the season, the semi-final, everything else, it's one of my proudest moments, obviously, in football, of winning an FA Cup. And it is a team game and part of that. But I'm ultra critical always of myself. I'm always introspective of looking at how I could have been better, any regrets, looking back of how I can improve, not to look for others for any excuses, whatever else. So I've always been that way inclined, is looking at the way in which I can never be satisfied, which drove me on to become a better player, I suppose.
Well, it's funny, I don't know if you heard the interview we did with Terry Gibson a couple of weeks ago, in which he said that he felt like during the game that he didn't get a single pass. And so he said, I must have got a few, but I don't remember. And then a few years later, someone had done an actual, an Opta scan of the game, and he didn't get a single pass in the entire match. He was on for 62 minutes. He already touched the ball 8 times, and that was from bobbled towards it. At one point in time, the ball hit him and ran away, and that was it. He didn't get a single pass from his own teammate. It's fantastic, but he's happily got his medal. But do you think you don't feel quite, or didn't feel quite, that you'd played the part that you wanted to in that game?
And you appreciate that sometimes that's how seasons go, how cup matches go, how influenced a game can be by you or somebody else. It's all about, obviously, the collective ultimate win at the end of the day. And that season was a phenomenal success, both in the league, really, in relation to where we were and the squad we had, and of course, the FA Cup.
Because we finished 8th that year. People forget that really, I don't know, as a player, it bugged you at the time, but it was held up as one of the greatest FA Cup shocks. We were only 7 places below them in the league.
Exactly. But that's what people... It's quite nice. It goes down in the annals of history of football as one of the great sort of moments and triumphs. And yeah, to us, it wasn't the great shock that sort of history has written about it in quite that way.
Yeah, it definitely wasn't at all. I agree.
Yeah, but never get in the way of a good story. Yeah.
Oh, God, no. Just let's spoil it with a fact. okay, so we have another question from Marco Cura. Marco asks, John, which is quite nice, he's named you in case you'd forgotten. John, which Wimbledon manager brought the best out of you?
Which manager?
Yes, which Wimbledon manager brought the best?
A Wimbledon manager, yeah.
We're getting Peter With.
You don't bring Peter With.
Don't bring Peter With. We're not going to mention Peter With.
Funny, it was on the tip of my tongue.
liar.
I've got to say Bobby Gould. I've got to say Bobby. You know, he was my manager at Bristol Rovers. He plucked me from obscurity. I'd been released by Leeds. I was going to go back to college. It was the last thing I thought I was going to do was play football professionally. I had the chance at Leeds. They let me go after 15 months. And sort of Bobby met me at Sheffield United at Bramall Lane, invited me down to Bristol. I came down, had a trial, had a shocker pre-season against, I think, Tony Cotty. Got dragged off at halftime. Thought, well, I've had a second chance and blown it. Anyway, a month later, I signed up my first pro contract with Bobby. And then, of course, when he got the job at Wimbledon 2 years later, brought me with him. And it just enabled me to be in that situation at Wimbledon when, yeah, I found it tough, but it was tough love. That's what the dressing room was about. It was, you know, you sink or swim, but that's to make you a player of the ilk that is needed within that dressing room. You make it or you don't. And Bobby always stood by me in those circumstances. He brought Don Howe in, which was a masterstroke, not only for the team and the FA Cup win, but also for me. I learned an unbelievable amount from Don and how to organise, because I'd come as a fullback. Within a year after that cup final, I'd moved into centre-half. Only at that point, after the cup final, did I sort of feel comfortable in that position, feel comfortable in my skin, feel comfortable that this was my career and I had the potential to go on and actually become a top-class footballer. And so I think I've got Bobby's got to be that man.
Because that year that you joined us was 87, when you, not being rude, but when we... Obviously, when Dave Bassett left, a lot of other players left, and Glenn Hodges and Nigel Winterburn, Dave Bassett left, a lot of new players came in. And then that was, obviously, you won them, you and Terry Phelan came in as the fullbacks. And we had to go into our Rothmans football yearbook to find out where you'd played before. And we'd seen that both of you were... Did you know Terry from Leeds?
Yeah, he was a young lad at Leeds with me.
Yeah. So we had that connection. And it was just finding it, obviously, nowadays, it's far easier to know who players are, but... So that was a big thing for him. That first game, we lost to Watford, of course, Dave Bassett's first game as manager. That was a really strange thing for us, seeing our team completely change. Alan Court wore the number 4 shirt, and then he brought Steve Gallies back at number 7. I don't think Steve Gallies played after that. This was just strange things, like watching a team of strangers. Of course, we did in 2002, watching a team, literal of strangers. So was that a big thing for you, joining that club, joining those players had gone? Was that a kind of a pressure to sort of to keep that momentum going, having gone from non-league to Premier League in such a short time?
Oh, I think the pressure that season when I joined was, it was palpable that the old brigade knew that the sort of there was a completely new beginning with Bobby, with new players, with needing to evolve to consolidate in the top flight, challenge, you know, that players were going to leave because they'd made a name for themselves. And I think there were quite a few players who obviously struggled with that, and understandably so. And it made it quite a volatile dressing room, as if it wasn't volatile enough anyway. So I think that year of transition was tough. And it makes the story even more remarkable that we ended up, you know, in 88 winning the FA Cup, because you just couldn't have written the script when you saw some of the chaotic moments that happened just 12 months earlier.
Yeah. That's, I can't imagine. So we had Vaughan Ryan on the show. Was that last week? Time has just stopped for me. Was that last week, George?
Yes, it was last week.
We had Vaughan Ryan on last week. And he was basically sort of saying that Don Howe made him as a player. And his effect on people was incredible. So how did you fit in to that dressing room? I mean, again, this is not meant to be an insult, but you don't sound like a typical footballer. I mean that as a compliment. But when you listen to Vaughan Ryan speak, Vaughan Ryan sounds like your average footballer, and he says it himself. But because you were educated, you come from, you know, you come down from. You're from Yorkshire, aren't you originally?
Yeah.
So I just think that must have been a really difficult. The most difficult dressing room to be a part of if you didn't fit into that personality sort of envelope that they created. How did you do that?
I think you've got to dig deep. There were times when, like many, it was a real struggle. And, you know, I had conversation with my dad, I remember, you know, saying, you know, this isn't for me. On a number of occasions, I just, you know, wasn't fitting in, wasn't comfortable, wasn't enjoying it. I wasn't really prepared for the harshness of that dressing room. And as I said before, you know, it was a sink or swim. It was part of the induction process. It was an eye-opener. And, I was 20 then. You know, it wasn't like I was 16, you know, coming to club. I was 20, but I was relatively naive. I was pretty shy lad. I'd grown up at home. My dad had left when I was 10. I grew up with my two sisters and my mum and a pretty sheltered sort of life. And I hadn't been at a club as an apprentice. And so I hadn't been used to that environment for very long. Although I'd been at Leeds and Bristol Rovers, I'd had a bit of an insight into it, but there was nothing that sort of prepared you for Wally Downs and the gang. And I think from that perspective, Alan Cork was great. He was my roommate. Alan Cork, in a way, took me under his wing. I got through it by socialising with the lads and going out and you know, trying to integrate myself in the dressing room and be a part of that. And yeah, there were difficulties, but at the same time, you understood that ever since I've understood that the beauty of Wimbledon was that it was self-regulating. The dressing room regulated itself. And you very rarely see that now. You used to see it a lot back then, but Wimbledon was the ultimate of self-regulation, where the players would dig each other out. And you soon got to know that it wasn't personal. It was actually the common good of the team. Was at the centre of every player, because there was an overwhelming desire and drive to win. They were all winners. They were all competitive. They were all of an ilk that had something to prove. And I think the players that played for Wimbledon had a point to prove. There was no sort of room for, I was going to say egos, but that's not true. There were a lot of egos.
There's no room for them.
That would have been the wrong thing to say. There were lads who knew what their strengths were and what their weaknesses were. And you find that out, and you work on those, and you work with Don Howe and Bobby and the players, and you learn to flourish in that. Otherwise, you drop away, and I would have fallen away and gone off somewhere else. But I didn't. I dug deep, and you know, I think a lot of that comes from my mum. My mum is a phenomenally strong character. My dad's not with us now; he died a year and a half ago. But my mum is a phenomenally strong character, and. There's something within me that allowed me to cope with that and flourish.
Because the thing is, I think people forget, when we won the cup, you were younger than George is now. That's extraordinary. Sorry, George, I don't mean about it as an insult to you. So it's an observation. So John, are you June 66 or July 66?
July 4th, 66, yeah.
So just before we won the World Cup?
Yeah.
Actually, someone older than me on the show. Thank God for that.
Yeah, I remember it well. I was nearly
26 days old. Yes, exactly. You can remember that. Definitely, I'm over the line with it. So we do have some games. By the way, we refer to ourselves as the development squad here because we know, you know.
The
work in progress.
We are the development squad. So we do have a player game. So, George, in your clearest English, can you explain to John how this game works, please? Because it can,
with
the wrong hands, be very, very confusing.
Yeah. Okay, so sort of a guesser player, and this is a player who played with you at Wimbledon.
So, oh, I'm not good at these. I'm not good at these games.
Oh. That's all right, another away.
That's all right. Start.
I'm losing the connection.
There's three types of clue, though. So, George, explain the first round of clues.
So the first round of clues is going to be five players this player has played with at different clubs across their career. The second round of clues will be two managers this player has played under. And then there's a third and final clue, which will give you a bit more information to hopefully narrow it down a bit. Does that make any sense?
It makes sense, yeah. But it, that's not difficult to follow, but yeah.
Yeah.
It's unfortunately, we have to double check because George is the one saying it. So
Yeah.
And doesn't this guarantee that these players have ever existed, let alone played?
Existed.
Ali Bongo, hang on, that's a magician. Come on. Go on, George.
Okay, so the five players are Neil Sullivan, yep. Jason Yule, Kevin Phillips, Don Hutchinson, and David Connolly.
Sullivan, Yule. Who was after Yule?
Kevin Phillips.
Phillips, yeah.
Don Hutchinson and David Connolly.
Oh, I wonder.
So those five players have all played with the same Wimbledon player that you played with. Okay.
They played with John as well.
Yes, yes.
At Wimbledon.
Yes, they played with John.
Oh, I'm out.
Yes.
I had it then. I thought I had it. I thought it would be well clever. No.
Yeah, I just got it, and then Rosie didn't play for us at all.
So he told you we were crap at this, John. You're all right. You're in good hands.
I've gone quiet, haven't I? I know. I'm trying to access Google, but I can't find it.
Lord,
no. Yeah, which player has? Yeah, no, yeah, that's not going to work. Okay.
Hello.
Oh.
Did we go to the managerial clues? Would that
I
help?
Think
we haven't guessed any players yet, have we?
We don't know, Kevin.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking. We might have to go straight to the managerial clues.
Okay,
you can have a guess if you want.
I've not got to have a guess. Did he play with Don Hutchinson at West Ham?
Well, I'm presuming that. No. Oh. Is it Leonardson? No.
No.
I've got to
mention that. No. Because
didn't play with Jason, did he?
No.
He didn't Jason play with David Connolly. Yes. Leo played with Jason Yule at Matlock. But David Connolly?
No.
No.
Go on, managers.
Okay, Brian Robson and Alan Pardew.
Oh. Brian Robson.
No, I was going to say that. Don't know if you...
I'm going to embarrass myself. Is that Middlesbrough or...
No.
Yeah, got to be, isn't it? Who else has Brian Robson managed? He's such a distant figure now from football, isn't he? Did he manage West Brom? Go on. It's a good one, George.
Yeah.
This is a good one. Okay, my question here is it a goalkeeper?
No, it's not a goalkeeper.
No, that would infinitely narrow it down.
No. No, it doesn't. I just had a feeling it was going to be him. Okay.
Yeah, not a goalkeeper, no.
Did he play with Kevin Phillips at Birmingham?
No.
This is actually Guess Who at this point.
Is he a left back?
Does he have a beard?
Does he wear glasses? Has he got a beard?
Let's flip him over, as it were. Oh, no.
It's not a left back, is it?
No, I don't think so. I could be wrong. He might have played a left back at times, but I don't think he was predominantly a left back.
He wasn't. Oh, God. I don't know. You foxed me, George. This is the best one you've done.
We'll have to fact check it later, Kev.
Yes. Barry Chuckle. Hang on a minute. That's not.
Gene Hunt?
I think we're going to have to go for the giveaway clue, George.
The giveaway, yeah. Wow, first time.
Yeah, well, there's two giveaway clues because I thought it was a difficult one.
Okay.
He joined us in 1991, and he played over 150 games for us.
Yeah, and gone. Next bit.
The next round is his initials. Yeah. 1991, it's not Andy Clark, then.
No. He came through our youth academy.
Did he?
That would be the bonus one.
Kent, right,
you're too generous, thanks.
Do you know what year he made his debut for us?
I think it was his debut was in 91.
From our youth academy.
From our youth. Well, so he played at 17 then?
Got to be Chris Perry.
Andy Thorne.
Not Andy Thorne.
Oh, hasn't it got
to be Chris Perry then?
Yes, it is Chris.
It is Chris Perry.
It is Chris Perry. Well done.
Chris Perry, of course, yeah. Well done.
Go on, tell us all these
Brian
things.
Brian Robson one foxed me.
Yeah,
and Don Hutchinson for that matter.
Yeah, so he played with Neil Sullivan at Tottenham.
Yep.
Jason Yule at Charlton, Kevin Phillips at West Brom, Don Hutchinson at Luton, and obviously David Connolly at Southampton.
Obviously.
The managerial clues for Brian Robson at West Brom.
Oh, West Brom, yeah.
And Alan Pardew also at Southampton.
Where did he play with Don Hutchinson again? Missed that bit.
Luton.
Luton?
I forgot he went to Luton.
I've forgotten he got to Luton as well.
I forgot. Didn't even know Don Hutchinson played for anyone but West Ham, so I really am out of it.
And Liverpool.
And Liverpool, yeah.
And Liverpool.
That's, as well. That's a good one, George.
That was good, George.
Yeah.
I think, Kevin, you got West Brom with Brian Robson. I think you didn't really got anything out of that lot.
I'll take any credit that's going, I'll take it. Oh, well.
Joining in 91 from the Youth Academy and getting 150 was...
Yeah.
It down to a few, I think.
Good one.
Well done. Very good.
Well done, George.
So, your Liverpool move then. again, you're one of those players that when you left us, no one begrudged you and you did go on to bigger and better things. And a lot of players leave Wimbledon with the idea they're going to go on to bigger and better things and don't for some reason. But you certainly did. Did you enjoy... So who was it? Roy Evans would have signed you then?
Yeah.
So how was it for you now being gone from a smaller club that everybody hated to being at a much, much bigger club that everybody didn't like either? But was it kind of a culture shock going from the way that we did things to the way...
It was quite bizarre in a way because, you know, I imagined... You know, walking through the Anfield gates and going in there and going to Melwood training ground, and the imagination when I was at Haydock Thistle, you know, staying at the hotel ready to, you know, get signed and play and train and everything else, it was going to be walking to some incredible setup and on a completely different level.
Yeah.
And, you know, as soon as I walked into training that first morning, same bunch of lads, same banter. Facilities that weren't unbelievable at all. It was Melwood. It was old school. It had the barriers, the rebound boards that Ronnie Moran had every, you know, set of players running through for the last 30 years or whatever. It was just old school. When you went into the car park at Anfield, it was the temporary hut, sort of the merchandising was, you know, just very normal and pretty poor considering it was Liverpool Football Club. I expected so much more in so many ways. But the wake-up call was when I played the first game. I think it was West Ham, I think it was my first game. Just walking out and down the tunnel and tapping the This Is Anfield sign and running out and up the steps and the adrenaline rush, the hairs on the back of your neck standing up, the roar of knowing you're a Liverpool player stepping onto that sort of hallowed turf in that stadium is a feeling, you know, you can't really sort of sum up. but electric. And after the game, you realise that that's what it's about. It's about that 90 minutes on the pitch. Yeah, just unusual because your expectation of being a Liverpool player was just you had to play consistently at the top of your game. You had to fit in. You had to know what your job was. You were left, I think, a little bit old school Liverpool, a little bit to your own devices that you were bought to do a job. And therefore, the coaching on the pitch wasn't what I expected. It was much more about the fluidity of five-a-sides and playing the game and understanding your teammates and sort of having a shape and a pattern of play and things that you might have expected would have been on a different level and maybe there were other clubs. But it was quite a relaxed environment. And, you know, that suited me. You do think there was a slight lack of that sort of real edge from a player on the pitch or from Roy Evans. Roy Evans really didn't have that edge to him. Probably why we fell short. And the leaders on the pitch had sort of... John Barnes, had, you know, he was in a different phase of his career. One or two other players from the era of success had sort of left. And it was just a sort of frustrating because the talent in that team was as good as, I think, any squad in the last 30 years.
I was just about to say that.
Steve McManaman, Jamie Redknapp, Jan Roll, Ian Rush, John Barnes. I mean, you go through the players and it was a phenomenally talented group of players and we didn't fulfil our potential and that was really frustrating ultimately.
Was there any pressure, because obviously you're looking at a Liverpool team that hadn't won the title for a while, did you feel any pressure or did that team feel any pressure from the fans that they wanted to get back to what they were like in the late 80s? Was that, did you ever feel that?
Oh, absolutely. And you felt it most when the crowd went quiet, you know, and you could hear a pin drop inside Anfield and you just, the thing about the Liverpool fans is they're, I mean, most fans know the game. You know, or every fan, I think, knows the game. And every fan can see out on a pitch what's going right and what's going wrong. Now, they couldn't influence it and put it right and work with the players and, you know, coach on that level. But they can identify what's going on. And there is nowhere like Anfield when things aren't going well. Yeah. The players have absolutely left in no doubt that we're falling short. Let's put it that way. And that's a tough place to be when it's like that.
Must be hard work.
Difficult.
Yeah.
It must have been a shock from... not that long ago, again, no insult mentioned, you've gone from playing with John Gale to playing with Robbie Fowler. And then, did Ian Rush would have been there then still? Was that his last season?
Yeah.
So it must have been an extraordinary thing, not as a culture shock, but as a sort of watching the players in training around you, just doing incredible things where, you know, we had players that didn't. They came from non-league and we loved them for it. It was no point an insult. But was that difficult to believe that you were in that company, not saying, you know, not that you didn't deserve to be, but to think of, wow.
No, I know what you mean. I know what you're saying. No, I think by the time I went there, when I was 27, 28, I played against all those players for years and I knew what it was all about. It was exactly where I wanted to be. I would have loved to have moved from Wimbledon maybe two or three years earlier when I was 24, 25, because I think when you get to 28, you're conditioned to think you're almost on borrowed time. I mean, you go from your peak to going downhill within about 2 years. It's ridiculous. And it's just, yeah, you're not really in that frame of mind as when you're a player and when you're in the dressing room, you don't look around and think in those sort of terms. You only reflect on that when you're talking like this or you look back on it and understand what the players you played with achieved throughout their career.
So what about the Tottenham move? How did that come about? Because you were at Liverpool for what, 4 years?
I was at Liverpool for 3 years, just right. Short of 3 years. That came about because Leeds came in for me. I'd been injured after the 96 FA Cup final, the white suits, the Cantona goal. I was talking about a new contract and whatever. And then I came back to pre-season. I tore my calf dreadfully. It was a funny time that summer. And... within about 4 months, I'd got back fit, got back in the squad, and Roy Evans called me and said, look, Leeds United have come in for you. We've accepted the bid. You know, you're at liberty to go and speak to them and talk to them. And I said, well, you know, we've talked about a new contract. We've talked about this, that and the other. What do you think? And he said, well, look, you know, the club's accepted the offer. And I said, well, that tells me everything. You know, that's that tells me everything. I'll go and speak to them then. Clearly, you know, I'm suddenly gone from wherever not to being in your sort of essential plans. They were signing Kavame. Do you remember Bjorn Kavame?
Oh, yeah.
And I went over to speak to Leeds. There was an agent, Eric Hall. You remember Eric Hall, Monster, the famous agent who had been, had engineered his way into my sort of situation at Liverpool. He'd engineered his way into Leeds, and I saw Bill Fotherby, the chairman at Leeds. George Graham was the manager. Had a great chat with George. Had huge respect for him. Everybody thought I would go back to my home roots in Leeds. That I didn't feel comfortable. For whatever reason, I didn't feel comfortable going back into sort of, not to be big-headed, but sort of a big fish going back into Leeds and all my mates. And at that stage where I really wanted to still be driven to, you know, not just go back to my hometown. I had some business interests, a licensing business I was working with in London. I loved my life in London before. I was really frustrated that Liverpool had sort of indicated they wanted me to go. And at that point, Spurs came in and I was asked to fly down to London, met Alan Sugar and his son, Simon Sugar. They drove me out to Alan's house, met Jerry Francis, the manager, who I knew from my Bristol Rovers days, had a great meeting. Had a great sort of negotiation on my own with them and said, look, this is, look, I'll be straightforward. This is where I am with Leeds. This is where I am. I'm absolutely willing to listen to what you've got to say and the plans. And within 2 hours, 3 hours, I was driving into White Hart Lane, signing the contract, saw all the Spurs lads going out in the Christmas party. never caught them up, but just that's how that all came about. Yeah. And funny enough, that night I rang Bill Fotherby. He slammed the phone down on me. I'd interrupted a TV program. He was insulted that I'd said no to Leeds. George Graham said, look, you know, whatever. And, you know, so be it. I understand, you know, the choices you make. And I'm up here. And one day, maybe I'll be back in London. I saw him a couple of months later. And thank God I sent him a nice bottle of wine over in Scalini's in Knightsbridge and made our peace. And he ended up my manager of Spurs, of course, a couple of years later or whenever. Got on brilliantly with George. I like George. And that's how that all came about. The first game, of course, that next Saturday was Leeds away. I got absolutely huge, like you can't imagine.
Of course it was.
Yes. I can imagine that. What happened? So where did you go from Tottenham? Did it? I have to say, I sort of lost track of your career from then. Where did you go?
I had a season at Ipswich at the end. I had a funny time with the injuries. That calf injury manifested itself in a torn muscle in the other side, a hamstring strain, an imbalance, a spiral of repetitive issues that were just embarrassing first and foremost, catastrophic for my career. And I never got to the bottom of it. I went off to Holland, see specialists, Muller Wolfhart in Germany. I saw Olympic specialists across the thing. I paid for all sorts of trips to see specialists. I could never get it resolved, and it still bothers me today. No. And I had an operation. I came back from the operation, played the last couple of games against Manchester United. You know, I wasn't really fit. I'd had scar tissue and two big operations down the back of both calves to remove scar tissue, which created a secondary problems. And George Burley asked me to go and play for Ipswich. And I had that season with them, but I hardly featured that final season of my career at Ipswich. But that was a great year to be around George and that group of players at Ipswich when they did brilliantly. That was a good experience.
So what year was that at that point?
I think that was 2000-2001 season. I think I retired in 2001.
Right, yeah, so you're 35 into that season then, yeah. Okay. I lost track, but I just couldn't remember whether you went after that, because it's not Sheffield United. You're one of the few players that didn't leave for Sheffield. Quite nice. My other podcast, but I won't mention the name of it because it's probably rude to do that. We had Charlie Webster on yesterday, broadcaster, and he's a massive Sheffield United fan. I think there's about 11 players that have played for both clubs. We forgot about Vinny, but it's Kevin Gage and Mark Morris and Hodges, Wally Down, Simon Tracy. It's an incredible amount of players that trained with two teams. Extraordinary.
My journey to Wimbledon started in the car park of Bramall Lane, so I suppose I've got a slight connection.
Yes, that's true.
We'll take that.
Yeah.
It's close enough, isn't it?
Yeah.
Right, we have another game, if you don't mind. So this is a game of...
I do.
It's kind of...
If I say I do.
We're going to do it anyway. We do, you haven't got to join in. It's called the yes no game, although most of it does not contain a yes or no answer. We need to change the name of this. So we're giving you it's a rapid fire game with you have to answer either yes or no, or it's choices, and it's a bit daft. So if you're okay with this, we'll give it a go. There's no right or wrong answers, but the last three questions are all right or wrong answers. But podcast, okay, ready?
Is there a warning that the last three are coming up? That they are.
Yes, there are. The first of those three questions is a choice between two clubs slightly north of London. That's the sign that there's only three questions left.
Slightly north.
Well, one of them gets called a London club, doesn't it? But which is complete rubbish. They are Southend. Anyway, here we go. Ready?
Yep.
Pineapple on pizza? Yes or no?
Sorry, start. What?
Pineapple.
Sorry, is this fast track? Are you deliberately talking fast?
Yes.
Okay, go on then. Yes. Let's go.
Because I'm trying to get over it. So okay. Pineapple on pizza, yes or no?
No.
Abandon the season or play to a finish behind closed doors?
Behind closed doors finish.
Did Carol Baskin kill her husband? I don't know that one.
No idea.
Okay, good. Lost or Manifest? The TV shows.
No. Neither.
Okay, fine. Prunella Scales or Chicago Bears Patrick Scales?
Patrick Scales, yeah, obviously.
Yeah. A week in Barbados with Laurie Sanchez or a week in Bexhill-on-Sea with Carol Vorderman?
Carol Vorderman all day long.
Okay, fine. VAR, yes or no?
Which isn't a great choice, that. Sorry, VAR.
VAR, yes or no?
Yes.
Okay, here's the last three questions. Luton or Watford?
Watford.
Okay, that's the order.
Should
we sack George, yes or no?
I know it's the wrong answer. I can't go back now. Did we what?
Should we sack George, yes or no?
Oh, absolutely, yes.
Okay, fine. And the final question, when you're making tea, do you put the bag in first or the milk in first?
You put the bag in first.
Correct. So, Nick, who presents this show more often than not...
Can I change my mind on Luton, I think?
Yes, you can.
You can, yes, absolutely.
That would make him very happy indeed. Thank you very much for doing that. George, do we have any more questions? Or do you have a question for John?
No more questions from our... left. No more questions from our listeners.
No more questions
from our listeners. You've run out of credit on the fee anyway. So.
There was a fee.
I do have a question about goals. Okay, so as a fan, I have only applauded an opposition goal on four occasions. I've been going since 1977. So the Beckham one, obviously, from halfway line, cannot applaud that. The Tony Yeboah goal in 95.
Leeds,
had to applaud that one.
Yeah.
The 2005, we played Harrow Borough at home.
And you remember this one, John?
Albert Adoma, eh?
You remember this one, John?
Yeah, no.
Of course I do. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Albert Adoma
scored. Dribble. Yeah.
Brilliant. Straight over the top.
Yeah, thank you. Albert Adoma scored an incredible goal for Harrow Borough against us, off his chest, off his knee, ball in the top corner. I had to applaud it. Now, the other game I remember applauding was definitely one you played in. Southampton away. I think it was 94 when Letizia flicked that free kick up and followed it past Hans Zegers. When you're the opposition and the other team score an incredible goal like that, or the Beckham one, is there ever a temptation to kind of congratulate them? Because
No.
As a football person, think, Christ, what a great goal.
No.
Does it ever change your mind?
No.
Okay.
Good.
No, Cantona scored the same at Selhurst Park. Do you remember Cantona's goal where I go out and confront him and I sort of turn, half turn, and it's one of his favourite ever goals and he volleys it in the top corner and you think, you just humiliated me with that. I mean, there's nothing I could have done about it.
Yeah.
But it's just humiliating. So in the moment, you feel like, I won't swear on the radio, but on the podcast. You're not quite that impressed at the in the moment.
Yeah.
And he could have been a touch less smug about it as well, Git.
Yeah. Well, Letiz was a genius, though. I mean, he was just...
Letizia was fine.
Brilliant. A great lad. Great lad as well. I think he's just permanently on the golf course now. He has been for about the last 20 years. if you can do that. But we're in the Sky studio.
Mm. But you think how many caps he got for England? Seven or eight? It's just unbelievable, isn't it?
Unbelievable, yeah.
I remember someone told me that between Frank Worthington, Tony Curry, Alan Hudson, Matthew Letizia, their England caps combined is eight less than Carlton Palmer.
Jesus.
That's a great stat. How is that for a stat? That's a great way to end. Unless you want to stay on, John, please feel free to stay on. But I can't speak today. Cut this bit out, Nick. Have anyone else? Jesus Christ. Has anyone else got any questions for John?
I don't know if Jesus Christ has any questions for John, no.
We can ask him. Can we? Oh, no, he doesn't exist, in my opinion.
He's not. He doesn't listen. He hasn't subscribed to this podcast, has he?
No, and why would he?
He didn't. Well, apparently on that Friday, collapsed on
Sunday. He's in lockdown.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, the Sunday it started all over again. It's extraordinary. So in that time, John, pleasure. Thanks for your time. Appreciate you taking
That was great fun. You enjoyed that.
Whereabouts nice are you, by the way? We always ask our guest. You haven't got to give us the entire address. Whereabouts are you, other than you're in one of your rooms, but whereabouts are you living currently?
Do you know Wimbledon Village?
Yes.
I'm right next door, nearby the two great pubs, Hand in Hand, the Crooked Billet.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Up the Common. So I'm up around that area. So I love being out in the Common, love being up in Wimbledon Village, love this whole area, and I have always gravitated back towards this part of England. It's ideal, and I can't wait for the club to be back in Plough Lane. It's very exciting.
That's the whole thing, that we're going to get excited by that, and that's the prospect of the first few games, maybe. New ground.
Yep.
The team walk out, Will and I are going to lead our team out, our first game at Plough Lane, and there's no crowd. That's going to be disappointing as hell, isn't it? Unless we can stay at King's Meadow for another few months until that's possible. That would be my solution, that we don't move in until we can have a crowd. But who knows when that'll be. George, have you got any updates? So George is in the know.
We're looking at end of October opening for the new stadium. It's the latest.
Right, with no fans.
Well, no one knows on what the situation that's going to be, but we should be able to play our first game at New Plough Lane late October, early November. Hopefully with fans by that point.
Well, let's hope so. My chosen news story might give you hope, George, but that might be possible. Excellent. In that case, John, thanks for your time. Appreciate it.
Look, I love that.
New ground. Thanks for indeed.
Cheers, John.
Cheers, Kevin. Cheers, George. Cheers, Chris.
Thanks.
Cheers.
Okay, right. So we have the rest of the show to do. Now John is leaving us. That was a sound. John Scales makes a very elegant noise when he leaves a room. Isn't that nice?
They all do. Everyone does.
It wouldn't be a klaxon or a sort of a cough. As a nice
convincing.
That was lovely, wasn't it? So we're going to finish things. We've only got a few minutes left. But what a great guest.
Yeah,
I didn't to take that in the wrong way. Honestly, he doesn't sound like a footballer, but he doesn't, does he?
No, he's a very learned man.
He's like a learned man. He sounds like he could be a professor of physics or something. He just sounds like a very intelligent person.
I was going to ask him when he was on, but I wasn't sure because I think he made the Ties at one point, or he was involved in it. I think him and Laurie Sanchez were business owners of the club Ties at one point, but I might be wrong on that one. I didn't want to ask him because he wasn't.
There was one question I was going to ask him, and I didn't. And when we're off air in a few minutes' time, I'll ask you. I'll tell you what I was going to ask him, then you'll both go, no, I'm glad you didn't ask that. So, random news stories of the day. Chris, what is your...
Go to George first. It's a sport one. I'll come back to you.
George, what is your random news story of the day?
As Chris has hinted, weirdly enough, it's a sport story.
No!
Who would have thunk it?
And it's the news that has broken just before we started recording this, that Man United have been given permission to trial 1,500 safe standing places at Old Trafford from next season.
Okay.
Which is a major step in the direction of getting safe terracing and safe standing back into the game. Sadly, a couple of years too late for our new stadium, but it means we might be able to have a terrace at the new ground sooner than we thought.
So when the home end semi-permanent stand is removed...
Yes, we can install a safe.
Okay. Shall I do mine then? Because Chris, you're still thinking of yours. Mine.
I've got mine, cheeky.
Oh, go on then. All right,
then it will be a sport. No, if yours is a sport one, you go first.
No. It's not a sport one, but I'm going to go first anyway.
Mine is more a random one for me and my family, and, well, other people's families, if anybody's listening from the emergency services. As of next week, you can apply to be tested. And for anybody local to Wimbledon, it's only a short jaunt to Cheddington World Adventures, should you wish to go and get yourself... Well, basically have your brain tickled with a large cotton bud.
Yes, it's a very unpleasant test, but obviously it's massively worthy.
It's great, but it'll be massively beneficial. So if any of you are emergency workers or frontline staff, I think that includes anybody, basically, who's still working, more or less.
Yeah.
then make sure you tell your managers that you want to go, and you'll be allowed to go.
Is it Chessington World Adventures car park?
Drive-through. It looks like a takeaway, but they take it away from you.
Will Stu be able to get any Big Macs? I think that's all he cares about right now. He don't want a test. He just wants a Big Mac.
He gets However, you do get a nice text message. I don't know how long a text message takes to tell you whether you've got it or not, which is a bit harsh when you're driving away, thinking, I could have this phone. And your phone goes off and no pressure.
Yeah.
So you're not driving when it does.
And it's Absolute Radio saying, apply for £60,000 prize now. Yeah, it's one of those texts I get. Thanks for that. Didn't want that one. Anyway, so my one is medical firm Gilead have said that their COVID-19 vaccine is working on humans because they've done testing on rhesus monkeys. It's working on humans, apparently, which is good news. And from my friend in the medical profession says that as soon as any vaccine works, the large medical companies will be told, right, stop making whatever you're making and make this. And, you know, that will expedite the process exponentially. Thought he's too large words. There we go. Right.
Yeah, can we dial down the
I'm inspired by some words. It's an hour. It's, you know, okay. All right, mate. Sorry. There you go.
Yeah. All right, son.
That's quite all right. Just wait for my Craig Cash impression on next.
Oh,
so do we have things to do in lockdown? I'm going to stay with you, Chris. What is your recommended thing to do in lockdown?
Well, at the minute, because the weather's crap. We had this conversation before, George and I, and Nick, I know, is another exponent of the rain. What's annoying is it's currently I just started a set of days off because I still have to work. God loves. And it's pissing down with rain. So watch the rain is what I'm going to do during lockdown now because there's fuck all else I can do.
Well, that's good. Excellent. Thanks for that.
Not really.
So, George, what is the sport-related thing you're going to pick out?
It's Thursday at 2 p.m. on Sky Sports. It's going to be the cricket show where they're going to discuss how the ongoing situation's impacting the cricket. That's how likely are we to see any form of county cricket over the summer?
I think the answer to that is not. it's
not
fine. Out.
One's
a good one. And my one is still, I'm still listening to albums I've not heard for a long time. So today I played the album Viva Dead Ponies by the Fatima Mansions, who are an art rock group formed in Dublin in the late 80s, made some incredible albums, but the Viva Dead Ponies is a fantastic record. Also the word coruscating. I'm sorry, I'm going to use big words again. It's not an easy listen. But do set aside 43 and a half minutes and listen to Viva Dead Ponies by Fatima Mansions, and you will feel like a better person. So finally, we're going to end there, because no one's making any reactions to that at all.
There's no reactions required there, Kevin, I think.
No, but it came out in 1990. And I've just realised...
Why would we cheer dead horses? I can't work that out.
Viva Dead Ponies, yeah. So it came out 30 years ago tomorrow. I just realised that. That's isn't it?
Okay. You have got the stats this week.
I have, haven't I? But the one about Carl Palmer is a worry and a half, isn't it?
It's disturbing.
It's very disturbing.
It's even shit.
Well, that's in your opinion. Okay, so George, do we have the birthdays game for Chris and I?
Yes, we do.
Oh, good.
Sadly, no mirror reader today due to them running out of mirror editions at Nick's local newsagents.
So we say running out of mirror readers?
Okay. That is also highly likely.
Run out of mirror
readers. How many do we have so we can prepare?
We have got four celebrities and a former AFC Wimbledon player.
Oh, okay. Go on then.
Fire away.
Okay, so the first celebrity, Daniel Day-Lewis.
62.
60.
Chris is closer. It's 63.
Is it really? Wow. Yeah. Good. Okay. Yep.
Second up, Uma Thurman.
Ooh. Uma Thurman. I reckon today she's 50.
Oh, I was going to say 50. Higher or lower? Higher. 52.
She is 50.
Hey.
Third up is former England spin bowler Phil Tufnell.
Oh, I reckon he's 56.
No, a bit lower, 53.
Chris is closer again, it's 54.
2-1, Chris.
Come on.
And the final non-AFC Wimbledon-based celebrity is Anita Dobson.
Oh. Wife of Brian May, of course.
Indeed. And similar hair.
It's exactly the same hair, isn't it? It's extraordinary. Go on, Chris, you have a guess first then.
Hang on, I'm just thinking. I think 72.
73.
Oh, fuck off, Kevin.
That was low, Kevin. But eh? Thankfully, it hasn't worked. She is 71.
Hey. Ah.
And the AFC Wimbledon one is former AFC Wimbledon centre back, Pim Balkenstein.
Pim Balkenstein, good grief. So we signed him in 2012. 33.
Say five.
He is, in fact, 33.
Oh, there you go.
So I still lost, though. I got two dead right, but lost because Chris got the others nearer. So, well,
hey, listen, I'll go with nearly every time, which sounds like the title of my sex tape.
You know what mine is. I'm not going to discuss that. Anyway, well, thank you. Thank you.
That was it.
Thank you all for listening to this. John Scales was great. Join us again very, very soon. But the actual podcast itself is, of course, back on Friday. I don't know who's on that. George, do we have any idea who's on that? Or what are we doing?
On Friday, we will be continuing our look back at Kings Meadow years. This week, we'll be focusing on our first 2 years in the Football League.
Yes, and of course, we're also joined by actor Craig Cash, which I'm looking forward to.
Amazing.
There we are. I don't know why everyone's laughing. But anyway, nice. So thank you. Thanks for joining us, everyone. Stay safe, stay sane. Football will return one day. We're all nodding. It's going to come back, and you'll see us all again in the flesh at the new ground, which we are not going to call New Plough Lane to upset people. So
again, thanks for listening. George.
Yes. So thank you all for listening, and you will hear from us again very soon. Thanks.